excited to have Don here. I was talked to Garrett about him earlier, and Garrett was talking about the snowstorm that occurred when Don first came to Gloucester, and I was talking to my husband about him, and he was talking about reading The Poetics of Common Knowledge when Vincent Farini ordered it, and he was working at the bookstore, and then, you know, it being one of the first books that he read living in Gloucester. So I feel like my own ties to Don are whimsical and perhaps form their own mythology. I'm going to read a little bit of his own biography here. Among his publications, Don Bird is a poet and thinker. Among his publications are Charles Olson's Maximus, The Great Dime Store Centennial, and The Poetics of Common Knowledge. He lives in Brooklyn with Margie Bird and walks along the East River in the mornings. He is teaching his granddaughter, Maya Thompson, who lives nearby, to play chess. The clematis, sometimes known as traveler's joy, is his favorite flower, but he is also, he might say, like Olson, a poet who now more thinks than writes my nosegay. He is planning a novel set in the 2050s about robots and people with computer implants. There are killer mosquitoes, and many of the lower neighborhoods of New York are flooded. Without more, Don Bird.
I just made that up.
And now we're expecting it.
I have a lot of papers to shuffle here. I hope they don't get out of order, and I find myself having to ruffle through a lot of papers. But yes, I first arrived with Marge in Gloucester on January the 1st, 1970. In the middle of a blizzard. On the train, we came in, it was dark, and Marge had been reading Thomas Hardy and was sure we were going to perish before we found our bed and breakfast. But we found our bed and breakfast, which I think now is a dental shop up behind the Friendlies at the Circle, with the 128 Circle.
That's where Charlie gets his...
So we got up the next morning, and the blizzard was over, and the sun was out. And so, I mean, here I was in the center of the cosmos, you know. I mean, I'd been reading the Maximus poems, and, you know, I knew the whole mythology. I could find my way around just from from the map I had from Olson. And so I started down Washington Street, and I was walking along by the cemetery, and I met this person walking past me, counting their steps. Just the way Maximus counts his steps as he walks along Washington Street in letter May 2nd, 1959. And I was so taken back, I didn't stop him and say, "Hey, I know what you're doing," you know, which is what I should have done. But, I mean, there he was. I mean, so here we were already, you know, this was like Dublin, and we were the Joyce people in Dublin, you know. And no, I don't know who it was. I never did find out who it was. It may have been George Butterick. It may have been some of the Buffalo crew. But it may have been someone, you know, completely otherwise. And one of the things that I've thought a lot about is what it means to be a follower of Olson. Ed Norn said that there's no truck with his technique or his methods. And he says there's nothing you can learn from him because he's a master, and masters, you know, completely finish everything that they do. But at the same time, they leave a huge wake behind them, you know, that a lot of people find themselves in. And I found myself there, and Chuck Stein found himself there. I was, well, just speaking of my immediate contemporaries. And George Quasha and Dave Matlin, whom I think gave a reading here fairly recently, perhaps. And so I've, you know, for now 40-some years, trying to figure out, you know, where do you go? I mean, once Olson has happened, what do you do then? Which isn't to say that he did everything, but that, but he certainly opened up possibilities for what could be done that no one else had ever done before. And and I've had all kinds of ideas about what it was exactly that was important that he had done. And I think I was right every time I had one of these ideas, because he kept, you know, I kept getting deeper and deeper into what he was doing. And so I wrote the book. I wrote a doctoral dissertation on Olson. Then I waited around. I should have just published it then, in the early 70s. But I kept waiting around for the third volume of the Maximus Poems to be published so I could complete it. And of course, George Butterick was meticulous and slow. So that book didn't get published, we just discovered today, until 1980. We were at the library, the Ralph Maud Library down the street, with Garrett this afternoon. I actually, embarrassingly, didn't know exactly when that book was published, so it was, a copy of it was there. In the early 90s, I wrote the book that Amanda mentioned, called The Poetics of the Common Knowledge, which is more about Olson than it reveals. I mean, there's a chapter about Olson in it, but the entire book is really about Olson and Olson's attempt to understand the history of Western culture, actually, is what it's about. The problems of being a follower of Olson was one of the things I thought about talking about here. Then I decided that, no, I didn't really want to do that. So then I thought, I was thinking about, I saw that James Cook had become principal of the Gloucester High School. I thought, well, I mean, I'd been here sometime and had given a reading of Olson with a bunch of high school students, it was a great event and great fun, all these kids had reading Olson. So I thought, well, what I will do is I'll talk about how you would concoct an Olson curriculum for K through 12. This got me very involved in a long writing project about Olson and mathematics, because what I would think you would want to do is, if you're going to write about, make a curriculum, people don't notice this, but Olson's was deeply involved with the theory of mathematics. Probably two of the most influential books on his work after about 1956 were Alfred North Whitehead's Process and Reality and Hermann Weyl's Philosophy of Mathematics and Natural Science. And Whitehead and Weyl are two of the great mathematicians of the first half of the 20th century. And there are actually notebooks that in the archives at Storrs that I've looked at and studied, where it's obvious that he has Whitehead and Weyl open on the desk reading about the incredibly complex series of events that happened beginning among Melville's contemporaries, the new geometry and the new abstract kinds of algebra and the new abstract kinds of logic that appeared in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. If you have read and been puzzled by Equal That Is to the Real Itself, that essay on Melville, he's paraphrasing in there a great deal of Hermann Weyl's book that I just mentioned. And on the one hand, this is extremely high, sophisticated theory that neither Olson completely understood nor that I completely understood. But that he realized that what had happened with Melville and his contemporaries was a total change of what culture was and what knowing was going to be and what knowledge was going to be. And he worked on that literally from about 1956 to the end of his life. It never shows up very often in the work, directly or immediately. But it's certainly something that he's thinking about all the time. And it has to do not with what we normally think of as mathematics being arithmetic and calculations and that sort of thing, but it has to do with patterns and relationships and the ways in which our whole understanding of patterns and relationships changed in the 1830s and 1840s. And that even though Melville knew nothing about the mathematicians who were contemporary with him, he intuited it too. I mean, it wasn't just something that happened in mathematics often in this specialized corner of the world, but it was something that had happened in the air. And Olson talks about this repeatedly in terms of history events, where he says that that bronze wasn't created a single time in Corinth. It happened all over the place. When he says when flowers are ready to bloom, they bloom everywhere. Famous quotation that I don't remember the source of. Garrett could probably tell me the source of that. But anyway, so I actually wrote a very long, complicated lecture about Olson and mathematics. And I actually have it here with me. If anyone wants to hear it, I could read it. It'll take me about 3 hours. I decided to give more of a poetry reading and be the follower of Olson in whatever way I am or could be. Since I've been here, we got here Monday. And I actually wrote a poem entitled Poem to be Read in the Place of a Lecture on Olson and Mathematics. And I'll have to read it from my computer because I didn't get it printed out. The other person that I have has been a persistent bug in my head, buzzing in my ear, is Garrett Lansing. In 1963, Garrett said, "We are in a rough time, the most difficult transition of all, a real interchange of tinctures where a kind of personal life is being exchanged for a kind of universal." And then he said, a page or two later, this is from that wonderful, amazing manifesto called Burden of Set, which I would recommend to everyone to go read that again and again. I've been reading it for a long time. And it, anyway, a page or two later, he says, "It remains to be seen what cannot be permitted. It remains to be seen what cannot be permitted." So when we arrived in Gloucester that night, it was 1971. We'd just been through 1970, and Marge and I were living in Lawrence, Kansas. And people don't remember this, but Lawrence was one of those places in the 1960s and 1970 where the kind of violence that seems to be hovering around our world now was everywhere. In the spring of 1969, the student union of the University of Kansas was burned down. Pretty much, not entirely, but heavily. That summer, I was teaching a course, summer course, and I just read a passage that some of you may know in Melville, in which Ishmael is piloting the ship, and he gets fascinated by the fire of the blubber being cooked up, and he gets turned around and he almost wrecks the ship because of that. And he says, "Do not look into the fire, O man, it will turn thee, it will invert thee." And I just had read that, and there was this amazing explosion. And some student in the class, this was one of those kind of 1969 classes in which almost all the students were mostly unclothed. I mean, they had minimal clothes on in Kansas. And one of the students who obviously knew said, "Oh, that was the computer center." And it was the computer center. Banks burned down. And no one remembers this, but three students were shot and killed in Lawrence that summer. People remember Kent State. I will not say that it was because these were black students that is not remembered as well, but the police did a kind of an attack on the Black Student Union, which was not near the university, but connected with the university. So anyway, I mean, we arrived in Gloucester with that kind of heavy duty experience immediately behind us, and I guess I feel now that something like that is lurking. I don't know. But, so anyway, let me get to here and read you a poem to be read in the place of a lecture about Charles Olson and mathematics. About 1830, people began to think, not about things, but about what they did to things. They did something to something, and then they did something to the thing they did, and did something to that. Space changed, Lobachevsky, and space changed again, Riemann. Moby Dick won, Galois. The thing they did to the thing they did can be called the hand of infinity, between the thing and the thing done to the thing. Thus one counted 1, 2, 3, oom-pa-pa, it was waltz time. Herman Melville and Albert Einstein were cosmic waltzers, oom-pa-pa. It looked like Moby Dick had won, and it looked like Andrew Jackson had won. It looked like Bertrand Russell had won, and Harry Truman had won. Time ran away, oom-pa-pa. The world had no shape. What you did had only the shape that was its shape. But what you did to what you did, and what it did to what to you, this, oom-pa-pa, was still to be found out. As the neoplasms arrived from the future, without genetic baggage or known appetites, the neoplasms stepped forth on Earth and time whistled around their ears like small, beautiful birds of red and gold, never seen before. We knew how to count to three and contain the world therein, the entire world therein, between a one and a three, Gravelly Hill, Dogtown, and the Hesiodic cosmos. But the red and gold birds were strange, and the dipole of their song stretched to paradise. This was 1963. We knew how to count to three and stop, but we counted to two forever. Time and the birds were two and strange. The cause for melancholy in the creation and space of time. This was 1969. In 1969, speciation held. The speciated people sang in the sunshine. The other people attended this lecture. What we do with what we do to what we did is still to be found out. So anyway, the neoplasms, the weird people, the speciated people remained humans, and the neoplasms, we're the neoplasms, which is to say non-genetic, creative, perhaps cancerous, but at least not stuck with the repetition of the perfectly regular waltz time. And of course, Garrett is also one of the other facts that comes through in The Burden of Set, that piece I was quoting earlier, is that the reality is not one nor three, but two. Two is... 1, 2, 3, oom-pa-pa is space, kind of. I mean, to vastly oversimplify what non-Euclidean geometry is about. The way in which we have these two kinds of experience in our souls, we have, our kind of flow of things coming at us at the speed of light all the time. I mean, you're all out there coming at me, and I'm sending back out at the speed of light toward you. And that kind of experience is this raw phenomenological stuff that we live in and that we think of as one aspect of our lives. But there's that other side of it that we think about it. And we don't think about you can't think about the raw experience. But we think, oh, this is different from that. And so we've got these two halves, and we're always trying to put them together, and they rub together, and they make sparks, and they make grit, and they make time, I think. One of the ways to look at Olson's work is that from the beginning, really, until 1963, about, he was dealing with that three, with space, with, you know, he talks about this triad that's the topos, typos, and tropos, the space, the topos, the place, the typos as it hits you, and then the tropos, what you do with it, the trope, you know, you make an image out of it or something, and that's the 1, 2, 3 that I was talking about. But in 1963, he published the second volume of the Maximus poems, Maximus 4, 5, and 6. And he never published himself another book. What we have is the third volume was arranged and compiled by George Butterick, who was a wonderful man. I love George Butterick. But it was not it's not Olson's book. And it's not George's book either. I mean, it's George trying to figure out from this mass of piles. I mean, they backed a truck up to 28 Fort Square and kind of shuffled everything that was there into it and took it to the Thomas J. Dodd Research Center in Storrs and shuffled it out. And Marge and I were there in 1975, and it was by that time had been put into library boxes, but that was about all. I mean, you'd George would bring you out a box, and you'd say, "Oh, look, here's the manuscript of such and such poem." And George would say, "Oh, yeah, there are dozens of those." He always would. He'd never revise anything. He'd totally rewrite them all. So there were many copies of everything, but anyway, that was. But then, so in 1963, Olson, the Maximus 4, 5, and 6 comes up through 1963. And at that time, Olson started teaching at Buffalo. And he taught in 63, 64, and a little bit of 65. And it was a very hard time for him. He didn't like being away from Gloucester. Betty, his wife, was killed in a car wreck. But I've spent this summer actually reading John Clark's notes from his seminars on those the courses that he taught in Buffalo. And the interesting thing is that he's, instead of being talking about space, which he talked about since the beginning of his work, I mean, he didn't call me Ishmael, the first sentence is, "I take space to be the central fact of man born in America." And that space is hangs right up to the end of Maximus 4, 5, and 6, to where, I mean, where Gravelly Hill becomes the universe, that I, the poem that I mentioned in this poem of mine. But it was clear that he was, you know, getting ready to go on to the next stage, whatever that was going to be. And what becomes clear reading these notes and reading through, then, I mean, I've spent a little time, not nearly as much time as I'd like, but with reading the papers and Storrs. And, but it was obvious that it was, he had seen that it was time to deal with time. If you read the last volume of the Maximus poems with that in mind, that doesn't come through as extremely shiningly clear because it's not a constructed book. I mean, it's just the bits and pieces that George Butterick found that he thought would, you know, be of a reasonable thing to consider as part of the continuing Maximus poems, not anything that Olson structured to give a sense of what he was thinking about. But anyway, time was that... you know, that move from space to dealing with time. And of course, it was about that time, and about in the 60s sometime, that we began to feel the other impact from the 1830s, which was an immense growth of everything. Beginning about the 1830s, any production that you look at, whether it's population, industrial production, pig iron, new theories of any kind of science, new academic disciplines. From the 1830s on, the growth curve of everything just took off. And, and now we experience, our foremost focus on that, of course, is in global warming. But it's by no means the only way in which time has suddenly, it's too hot for the middle of September right now. And Olson somehow, didn't speak of it in those terms, but had that sense that suddenly it was time that was the dimension of our lives that had to be coped with, because we couldn't slow things down to be just space. If we could make everything space, everything happens at the same time, and the first parts of the Maximus poems, that's what they do. All of history is kind of there happening together. Contemporary Gloucester, he's walking down Main Street, and at the same time, the founding of Gloucester is going on in the same poem. So my answer to the question is, what does it mean to be a follower of Olson? Now, is not that I can go back to West Plains, Missouri, where I grew up in the Missouri Ozarks, and find a name for myself and write about the history of... it didn't have much history, for one thing. It was founded after the Civil War, so... To be a follower of Olson now means to pick up on, and unfortunately, one of the things that got shuffled away when I decided to change what I was going to do tonight is that I can't get access to it. In the next to last poem of Volume 3 of the Maximus poems, he says, I am walking in time, and various mythological levels of time that he's talking about. So anyway, what I had planned to do was still take 3 hours, because I'm obviously talking too much. But this is a book I published called The Great Dime Store Centennial, which was the 100th anniversary of the W.F. Woolworth stores. And this is the W.F. Woolworth store in Cohoes, New York, which is a little industrial town north of Albany. And it was the only place I could find where the old F.W. Woolworth in gold was sign was still... it's not... When this book was new, it was golder than it is here. I guess this was written 30 years ago, but I guess I feel the same way exactly right now. I was taking a nap this afternoon, getting ready to come over and read, and my cell phone binged. It was around 4:30, and my cell phone bings every day at that time, and it's Huffington Post sending me some horrible piece of news about Donald Trump. Call for a general strike. 1, government has failed. No power is invested in the public trust. All politics, therefore, is terrorism. The actions of individuals on behalf of private interests in the name of the people who are said to hold the title to the public reservoir of power. This is a worldwide phenomenon. 2, In the middle of the 17th century, human beings began to replicate themselves at an unprecedented rate. We may be running out of time and space. The world we have engineered in order to accommodate the numbers is a vast artifice, our truest work of art, and we inhabit it completely. There is no outside. The spectacular possibility of atomic war persists, of course, but life now on the planet is threatened by inert gases we spray into the atmosphere from aerosol cans of deodorant, by the possibility of man-made microorganisms to which we have no immunity, the inglorious destruction of fertile farmland, and oxygen-making forests. The great catastrophe might bring an ultimate moment of tragic self-awareness. We might see by the light of the firestorm in the moments following a nuclear war spasm that we have not been able to see otherwise, but it is at least as likely that meaningless and hopeless complexities will multiply until the simplest acts will become overwhelming and even the most vital will lose their taste for living. 3. Superstition and idolatry have never been so common, especially among the educated classes. We are so captivated by our ignorance that we call it knowledge. Education is initiation into the rites, spelled in two different ways, of private power. The motive of knowledge is greed. Consider, as a critique of the current state of knowledge, a cultural enterprise which would establish power for public use equivalent to the power which knowledge of the law of conservation of matter and energy delivered into the private hands. There is a kind of knowledge which is useful only when it is shared, like locks which are opened by two keys, held by two people. The knowledge of language is of this nature. Of course, for the most part, language is used on earth for private purposes. It is used to say this or that, what this person thinks or feels, to give orders, to make contracts between private parties, to objectify the anguish of our isolation. 4. Poetry cannot solve these problems, but nothing less than poetry can solve them. This is difficult to speak of. Perhaps I can think of all art as being something like architecture. It is possible to create forms which, It is possible to create forms which are not expressions of the architect, the board of directors, of the great man, or the faceless bureaucracy. Forms that are specific to everyone involved in their use. The purest formalism demonstrates the possibility of such art, but then architecture is never purely formal. Its content is not steel and concrete, but lives. The failure of functionalism was not theoretical. Rather, the functions which its forms tried to follow were dreary and tedious. An office building where the primary functions are typing and filing is certain to give rise to a form which itself is an image of ennui and habitual activity required of vested power. 5. But first, you must be a poet, someone said, demonstrating elegantly the rhetoric which leaves the discussion suspended. Wrong. First, you must stop. Stop, stop. Stop, stop, stop. I'm preparing to utter a most general word. Everything. Stop everything. 6. Things make sense because they go on. I'm demonstrating this truth. After some time, I will stop. Our diaphragms will go into uncontrollable spasms. It will be a painful experience for some, and we will all be frightened. This will be laughter. Some will fall rolling and pounding on the earth or floor. We must expect some casualties. Some will be unhappy by their laughter. We will need to treat them gently. During the following months, the fits of laughter will recur. When politicians, priests, and others who seek to return us to our senses rise to speak, there will be silence and laughter. In time, we will learn to trust the moral significance of this sign. Then someone will begin to speak. So anyway, that was in the 80s that I, that was Ronald Reagan's world, I guess, that I was trying stuff, which seems almost benign now, somehow. But it the power of laughter and everything involved with it seems like it might still be as powerful as it was then. Well, let's see. What am I going to try to read in the midst of all this? As I said in my the little biographical piece that Amanda read, I hadn't been writing much poetry. I'm not exactly sure why, but I hadn't. But I'd been writing more than I thought. I started digging around, and in fact, I found a rather substantial stack of stuff that I'd written over the last several years. You know, so I mean, I should have been trying to figure out what I was doing, and you know, I mean, finding these poems. Wow, I wrote this poem, you know, and some of them I barely remembered writing, and I'm sure that some of them I wrote as I wrote the poem to be read in the place of a lecture, you know, because I had a reading somewhere and I wanted something new to read. But I found these two poems, and they're really quite terrible. and in fact, they were not. I set out to see if I could write a poem that was awkward and that I was uncomfortable with, and that the images were all wrong. And I remembered I studied with Robert Duncan in the 60s, and he asked us to. Went around to everyone and said, name some quality in poetry that you don't like. And I said, flabby. And he said, well, your assignment for next week is to write one of those kind of poems that you don't like. And so I don't know that this was specifically some dislike that I... But anyway, I wrote a sequence of poems, and these two poems are from a sequence of poems that are neither beautiful nor good. A poem in which I climb a rope and become a dog. I do not know this morning why I am not a rope. I've taken off my shoes and my hair. I exhort the billionaires again. Let me start over. The billionaires climb ropes like cobras. They have eaten my shoes. They have used my hair. I am climbing a rope. I speak for a dog. Oh, billionaires of New York, why do you not climb a rope and become a dog? The poem that turns into a bank and an opossum. The marsupial also is a kind of institution of credit. The creditor thus is a kind of goat, and the cocktail also is a theory, or perhaps money, or monkeys. Finally, in this poem, Ted Cruz is not allowed, and David Bowie is not allowed. They destroy the poem, and it is a good poem, better than the Iliad. The barbarians will not burn it down. I do not want to write these poems. They bite me on the lip as a jumpy lover might bite me on an interesting night. Near the diner, where the magistrates meet and determine what might have happened. Had someone thought of it? We're out of it, I said, after 3 hours on the phone, staring into the pit of hell. These were obviously written during the last year when I was concerned about the political situation. See, get a little more time here. My copy of the big copy of the Maximus poems, the big brown copy, is full. falling apart and taped together with these big wide pieces of scotch tape. And this is not actually about, it's about that book. It's not necessarily about Olson's book, but it's about a big book, big brown book taped together with. I took the large book from the shelf. It was heavy, uncomfortably large and smelly, smelling of the dirty hands of an old man who sat too much and walked too little. For years had walked too little. I needed a lectern. The core of my studies for 50 years, I had wrestled the book, and the book had won. Or we had fought to a draw, or the wild, unsettled world beyond the library defeated us. I did not need to take the book from the shelf, as I'd done so many mornings after my coffee. I put the brown book on the black desk, folded my arms across my chest, and thought in the vicinity of the book until the bell rang, until the birds sang in the small oak tree in the lawn with croquet, the lawn sloping down toward the lake and the boathouse. I resumed my studies before the large, unopened book. I did not know if I or someone else had written the book. There were coffee stains, the bells rang, time started up. The world beyond the library rattled with weather and commerce. I did not rattle this morning. I did not sing. I did not rattle when I walked in the garden with the wise woman dressed in flowers, and we sang the unheard music until after dark. I spoke briefly of the large book to the company that had gathered. I spoke of the numbers that ended and the numbers that did not end. I spoke of the turbulence that rose in the numbers in the book, on the desk, in the dark, and in the morning. The bells rang, and the mourning doves mourned, and waves of turbulent numbers rose among the clanking of the bells and the mourning of the doves. It was autumn and winter, and autumn and winter. Death comes slowly to the large animal that is the administrative center of the large book, with a taped spine that I've studied for 50 years, wondering always what I learned and what I could sing thereafter, to make not the numbers, but the frisky formalism of the numbers known. Did the numbers populate the suburban towns north and east of the city? Did they take the organs of the large animals of the book with them? Did the suburban trains and automobiles sing the death song of the city and the large animal? Did the numbers forecast the coming of the smell that covered the land with false policy? Did the governors fall in the wells unmourned and unremembered? Did the administrators sleep and the power plant roar through the short days and long nights as the nights became longer? Did the music the buskers play drive the commuters mad, and did the music transport some of the commuters to addresses in the large book where the sun rose and the day lasted so long the beginnings were not remembered? No one remembered the first light of day, and no one remembered the first bird songs. The first things were forgotten, and the second things, the processing of the third things, overran the memory cache, and the numbers spilled out, running down the slope and into the lake. I sat before the large book on the dark, heavy desk. Days passed. Eons grew inside the drops that were time, more than I counted, more than choruses of counters could have counted. I spoke with Pythagoras and Heraclitus in the dark and heartbroken night about the numbers true and untrue, about the heartbreaking future from which I came and to which I would return. I sat before the large brown book that I knew as well as myself. Sometimes I think I wrote the book, and on other things it was another, not written by another, but whispered in my ear. It may have been that the book was not written at all. I'd lived the book, not what the book was about. Or everyone had lived the book and had arrived at the dark passage, smoke-smudged and sad-eyed. But you come from a world that made sense. Did you come from the world where the large animals lived? Were there books and sorrow in the world? Did people think they thought and think they could think and thought? Did people think they thought and think? Was the water in the wells cool and sweet? Was there time? Did the bird songs blossom like daffodils in spring? I sat before the large brown book, taped on the spine, like an old man. Let's see. I'll read one more poem, and then if anyone wants to talk or talk about any of the things that I've talked about, I can do that. This is an old poem, but one that's actually never been published except in a broadside. That actually I had to take it's on my wall in my study, and I had to take it down to type it out to have a copy of it to bring with me. I guess the base feeling that I've had all my life was that a kind of befuddlement before the world, and that the basic task of life is to overcome your befuddlement as best you can. And this poem is called The First Message, and it's In Memoriam, Paul Bird, who was my father. My father would have said about our current condition, well, we're between a shit and a sweat. These years, I watched my hands become his. Hours pass in the stream of thinking. My hands are still. My hands are still becoming his hands. It's spring again, the third, since his hands were stilled. His hands were never still. And when he called, the conversation was hampered because neither of us could say death. He would give me all the information I wanted as long as I could ask and he could answer. Without saying death. And I said, do you get hungry? And he said, yes, very hungry. And I said, who are the other people? And he said, I get hungry. And I said, what do you do day by day? And he said, I watch the waves break on the cliffs. And I said, what is your greatest joy? And he said, to watch the waves break on the cliffs. And I said, I'm asking the wrong questions. And he said, all the questions are wrong. And I said, I'm asking the wrong questions. And he said, are you hungry? And I said, I'm asking the wrong questions. And he said, what do you do day by day? And I said, I get hungry. And he said, I'm asking the wrong questions. So that's the befuddlement that one is always struggling with. And that having tried to make a little bit of sense here for you tonight, I will go back and face my befuddlement. as I go off to sleep. So anyway, I'm perfectly happy to talk about all this. If you want me to read the long lecture about Olson and mathematics, Willie says, no, I don't want that. if any of you are really interested in that, I'd be, you know, about, I was hoping a whole bunch of high school teachers would show up. And I could, but anyway, any questions or anything, stuff put to me?